So this is the second day. Can everyone hear me? Manfred, you can hear me? So this is the second day of this five-day retreat, Composting Fear into Fearlessness, Healing and Transforming the Separate Self Through the Practice of Non-Fear. Before we get into things today, just a couple of matters. One, on the meals, just a reminder about the protocol that one doesn't sort of take one's seat until one has one's plate. So if you go in early and you get tea or coffee, don't put that by a place to hold it, because then when people come to do the fill-in, that place will be empty. There'll be a teacup or a coffee cup there, and they'll just be waiting for someone who may or may not show up. So please keep your coffee or tea till you actually have your plate. Let me just say something about, there was a question about the groups. In our community, we practice something that comes down from the Thich Nhat Hanh community, which is called deep sharing, deep listening. And even though in our retreats we do it as a practice, it really is something, it's a model for how we should do relationship. So let me just say something about it. Though perhaps it was already explained in your small groups. Deep sharing. So it's, the emphasis is on deep. because it is often the case that people talk all the time, and a lot of people like to talk all the time. But their talk is often a smokescreen. Many people, their words are artifice. They are crafted consciously or unconsciously in order to impress, in order to get people to think they're worthy, they're smart, they're intelligent, to get people to like them, to love them. I mean, there are all kinds of egoistic needs that people are getting met by manipulating their speech. Other people refrain from speaking. Somebody who could be, let's say, shy or something, and often it's a similar kind of thing. They're afraid to speak because they are so concerned what people might think about them. So you can see whether one is going from, you know, one's very felicitous and easily speaks, or whether it doesn't speak at all. It may be because there is an artificiality around words that do not directly relate to experience. One of the things I think as a human being is to learn how to generate authenticity in one's communication. And again, that takes practice. And that's why we call it a practice, the practice of deep sharing. Because it really involves two parts. One part is, are we able to really be present, mindful of our own thoughts and feelings? Many people are not. So that's the first step. Am I willing to stop and be present to my own thoughts and feelings, my own true experience, what I'm thinking about? And two, can I find the words, and am I willing to take the risk of sharing authentically my experience without any concern about how it's received? Can you see the freedom in that? So deep sharing is a model. It's a model for how to be in relationship with partners, with family members, with friends, with colleagues. It's really something that is missing. Deep listening is also, for example, right now, everybody here appears to be listening to me, right? But who knows, right? People could be thinking about something that happened this morning, thinking about what comes later. People could be judging me. People could be judging what I'm saying. People can be thinking, how would I say this, right? That's not listening, are you? You're only hearing what? your own thoughts. Right? So deep listening is a profound practice. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, the greatest gift that we can offer another human being is our presence. Right. So learning to be a listener, which is something, you know, they that's what they teach in preschool, to be a good listener. I have a 3-year-old grandson we're working on his listening skills, but this is a little different kind of listening. Okay. So it's a wonderful practice. So that is why traditionally, when we do the practice of deep listening, deep sharing in our retreats, we don't do crosstalk, right? We don't comment on what anybody's saying. We don't give them advice. We don't tell them that what they do, this is how I handled it. One, because that's not what we're doing here. In other places, in other kind of groups, that could be done. But we're here, we're practicing deep listening, which means we have to keep this closed, which for some of us is not easy. Right. We are often great interrupters, and many of us are great advice givers. But please notice, very few people change because of advice. Right? I mean, I would imagine over the course of your life, many people have given you advice. You should do it this way. You shouldn't do it that way. Right? How many of you always take other people's advice? No, in most cases, we thank them, but we know better, or we resent it. And the other thing is, how much advice have we given other people? Even though we think our advice is very wise and appropriate, but they still continue on their way. Counsel, good counsel, good advice can be very helpful when the person's ready to hear it. Good counsel and good advice can be very beneficial at the right time, and if the person is open. My sense is one should always knock before entering the door. Oftentimes we don't knock first. So the practice of deep listening, deep sharing is what we're doing here. There is a facilitator in each of your groups who's been asked to facilitate. Their job is simply to make sure that everybody gets 5 or 10 minutes so they can share. If someone's maybe having a little difficulty, really, because we're sharing within the context of the last 24 hours. It's not like deep sharing everything in our life. So the deep sharing is the context within the silent retreat that we can have an opportunity to express our own insights, our own obstacles, our own experience, but also to get a sense of what other people are doing. Is that clear? So the facilitator is facilitating that. Also, the facilitators are there if somebody has any question. Okay, but again, the facilitator is there primarily to deep listen as well. Okay. Any question about the groups? Is that clear? So what I'd like just to keep things moving along, you know, there's like a list of the leaders group, you know, I can see your names with the people under you. So this is sort of like musical chairs. I'd like all the groups to stay the same in their same place, but I'd like all the leaders to move one step to the right. And you who are at the extreme right, you would move to the front of the line. Is that clear? But everybody in the group stays the same.
In the same room.
Same room, right. So you're trying to minimize confusion. So everybody just stay where you are. Leaders, one step to the right. Musical chairs. Except we won't take away the chair. Good. Question about what is the Sanskrit Pali word for impermanence? Anicca? Anicca? Somebody's getting drowsy when they practice by themselves. You know that drowsiness, it actually has a word, torpor. You see in a lot of the traditional Buddhist texts on meditation, torpor, sluggishness of the mind, is one of the great obstacles there are these two poles. One is a mind that is very active and jumpy and kind of like that. And this other is this mind that's kind of heavy, torpid. Okay. There are various ways. Again, it is an impediment, an obstacle, a contaminant of meditation, because obviously it is hard to concentrate and et cetera if you're on the verge of falling asleep, or if your mind has a heaviness to it. You know, there's kind of a kind of a sluggishness that the mind can fall into, even though it's just kind of not clear. It's, you know, it's torpid, right? It's turgid. It's kind of. Not good. The first good thing is to notice it, okay? So when it's arising, to notice it. In the same way, when you have a very agitated, busy mind, it's good to notice it and name it, okay? Now, how do you wake yourself up, right? Well, there are various ways to do that. There are physical ways. Right, there are certain ways you cannot do when you're in the meditation hall, because we are all sitting together and we have a schedule, and there are times when we can stand and times we can sit. But to a certainly when you're on your own or within a break, you can jump around a little bit. You know, just get some energy moving. Right, you can go throw some nice cold water on your face, kind of wake yourself up. Right, you can straighten up. You can, you know, take some deep breaths. I mean, in other words, there are things you can do to arouse yourself physically. Okay, sometimes if you know, just looking out, gazing out on a wider vista, is kind of wakes you up a bit. Right, get out of yourself. But the bottom line is, you want to feel a return of this kind of clarity and energy of the mind. Now, internally, there are other things we can do. We can remind ourselves of our aspiration and intention. You know, what am I doing here? You know. And remind yourself, oh, I'm cultivating clarity of mind. Oh, you know, and that kind of gets you back on track. It kind of, you know, sometimes you just, it's like coming out of the dream, coming out of the trance. Right, you just wake yourself up. Right? Traditionally, in the Buddhist meditators, have reflected on, guess what? Our old friend from last night, impermanence and death. Right? I assure us that if we had an hour to live, or this was our last day on earth, we probably would not be spending it, kind of drifting around in a torpid state, right? It's like there are things to do, right? To remind yourself of the precious opportunity that you've given yourself by coming on retreat, giving yourself the precious opportunity of looking deeply into your own mind, giving yourself the precious opportunity of really looking into your own conditioning, as we'll be doing over these next days, to really free yourself from your emotional afflictions. You know, what a wonderful opportunity. It is not here forever. We may never be back here again. We may never have this opportunity to go on retreat again. We think we do. We act as if this dreamlike world will just go on forever and ever the way it is. It doesn't work that way. Right? Sickness, changes in our body, mind, financial situation, work, home, family situations. There's lots of reasons that people, you know, can't go on retreat. Right? Right now, all of us have the opportunity. We may not have it in the future. So thinking in this way wakes you up, right? And it energizes you. So that's just a few suggestions. Well, somebody talked about a tree and sadness. We'll get into that later. So, yesterday was a big picture, right? because a lot of our fears, our anxieties, our anger, resentments, our irritations, our frustrations, our sadnesses, our despair, our worries are all based on a misperception of what's going on in life. Ideas we have about life that are not correct. They are distorted, they are skewed, they are ignorant. So again, developing right view and really seeing the world, and I just went into a few of the quote-unquote right views. And again, this is not right view like this is Buddhist view and therefore it's right. This is right view because it's based on reality. It's the right view of reality. It's the way things really are. It's the way things really are, whether you're a Buddhist, not a Buddhist, a Christian, a Hindu, a Jew, a Muslim. It doesn't matter what you are. It is right because this is what's going on in real. Impermanence is the truth for everybody. Doesn't matter what your religion or you're not. You could be an atheist. Impermanence is still true. The inherent unsatisfactoriness of worldly pursuits is true for everybody who invests a lot of time and energy in it. That's why they have to keep at it. Right up to the end. And enough is never enough. Why is not enough never enough? Enough money, enough success, enough achievement, enough books. Because there's something inherently unsatisfying in the achievement of those types of activities. And cause and effect, again, the law of karma, cause and effect, it operates in the world for everyone. Human, animal, animate, inanimate, world systems, it's all the same. So big picture, right? Please, we're going to get a little more focused today, but please don't forget the big picture, and I'll often be referring to the big picture. Because as we begin to unpack our fears and anxieties, they may relate to exactly what we're talking about. So just to keep us on track, let me read from the statement that was sent out as a description of this retreat. It said, although the Buddha taught that all beings experience a state of anxiety when they resist the impermanence and unpredictability of life, okay, sincere Dharma students often continue to struggle with long-standing fear-based emotional responses. Although longing to be happy and enjoy ease and well-being, they continue to be driven by strong habit energies of worry, anxiety, fear, self-doubt, even dread in their daily life. Why do we invest so much energy into avoiding and running away from our fears? Why, when fear arises, do we look away, act out, repress, avoid, smooth over, take a pill, go to the mall, or read another book on Buddhism? Good question. Buddhism teaches that to truly free the mind from fear, we can't simply deny or cover over its existence. Instead, we have to look deeply into the causes of our fears. In order to overcome our delusions around life that create our fears, we need to practice mindfulness, again, which we began doing yesterday, calming the mind and insight, to become intimate with these fears rather than trying to cast them out. Now, again, we are using fears in this retreat as the focus. But it could be said the same thing about your irritations, your frustrations, your anger, resentment, your sadnesses, your despair, your losses. I mean, it doesn't matter, your jealousies, your envies, it doesn't matter what it is. We need to learn how to be present to them, to look deeply into them, and to transform them. So by becoming intimate with these fears rather than trying to cast them out, by doing so, we discover a profound personal fearlessness within. We now have the capacity to live a courageous life. In this retreat, we will stop and meditate deeply on the nature of conscious and unconscious historical habit energies that drive our fear, anxiety, responses to life. Dharma talks, guided meditations, experiential exercises, group dialogues will clarify participants what nurtures and supports their self-created unhappiness and learn how to live a better and emotionally saner life. We will begin to integrate the reality of impermanence, transforming our view from one of resistance and fear to a deep appreciation of life's wonders. Well, that sounds pretty good. Is everybody with the program? If you're not, say so. So, hope and fear. Right? Fear and hope. This is what the Buddha said. This is ordinary people. We're always hoping, right, that things will turn out the way we want, that we'll get all we want, that life will be what we want it to be. And at the same time, we are what? We are afraid that it won't be that way, that we won't get what we want, that things will not turn out the way we want them. And that we're even most afraid that we'll get what we don't want, right? So that polarity, that duality between hope and fear and hope, is really often what is underneath a lot of our activity. And the reason we are such masters at control and manipulation of life, ourself, and others. We're trying to get it to turn out the way we want. And we're afraid that it won't be that way. And that is not a happy way to live. That is not someone who has hope and fear constantly and all the variations has a mind that's not at ease. There's always a disquiet. There's always an agitation. There's always something bubbling. Does that sound familiar? There's really no rest in that view. So today we are going to kind of step back from what we talked about yesterday, the kind of macro view of life. And we're going to now look into this mind. But again, I want us to have a context, the same way I wanted to give us a context yesterday for looking at life, because it is in life that anxieties arise. Okay, there's a good chance if you were born miraculously on a desert island and never encountered a human being, you may not have a life of anxiety. Right? Anxiety is something and fears you have developed in life, in relationship to life, in relationship to people, in the development of a self. But you will grant me that anxiety, fears, they arise where? Primarily. In the mind. Okay. So, before we jump into it, and I know people are just chomping at the bit to jump into it. Let us try to understand in Buddhist psychology, and Buddhism has a very detailed, some people call Buddhism really a psychology, system of psychology of the mind. And there are many ways to approach this. This is... So let us talk about this mind of ours. Okay? So we might say, I'm going to just be very simple for those of you who understand the complexity of it, forgive me. We might begin with saying there is awareness. Okay? Right? Like right now, everybody here, you are aware, aren't you? Right? How do you know you're aware? You're aware of your breath. You're aware of something. You're aware that you're breathing. You're aware of what? You're aware of sounds. You're aware of hot and cold sensations in the body. You're aware of thoughts. You're aware of mental events. You're aware of sights. You're aware of smells. You're aware of tastes. So there is this basic awareness, right? Which you may notice if you've ever been around a dead person. They don't have that. That is why we call them dead. Right? You look at them, and they still have eyes, they still have ears, they still have noses, they still have mouths, they still have bodies, right? They look exactly the same. Right? But there's something different. That awareness has left the body. The body is a shell. So the mind is the key thing here. The body, that again, why we say, yeah, take care of your body, but your body's just a vehicle. Don't be obsessed about your body. Don't spend your whole life thinking about your body, worrying about you. It's a vehicle. It's here to serve you. So there is this awareness, and it enters the world primarily through your senses. Okay, so I'm saying it, but please kind of feel it. All right? How do you know the world? I mean, how do you know the world? You see it. You hear it. You smell it. You taste it. And you sense it. Okay? It is through the five senses. And in Buddhist psychology, what goes on is there is a sense organ. Let's say the eye. That sees something, a thing. Okay? So the eye makes contact with an object. Okay? Like right now, your eye is seeing this or this. Okay? Your ears, the object of your ears are sounds. Right? The objects of your nose is odors, tastes, sensations. Is that clear? So there are five senses that make contact with the eye. That's the way we know the world. Okay? Through our senses. So when somebody said yesterday, what is reality? What is now? Well, you can always do this check. Okay? Your senses are always in the present. You don't smell in the past. You don't see into the future. You see what's right before you. You smell what's right, right? You hear. So your senses are always in the present. So that's a good check. That's the now. Now, you may remember odors, but that's just going on where? In your mind. You may anticipate sights, but that's just going on in your mind. The reality is what you're aware of right now, what you're mindful of right now. This is the now. This is the dividing line between past and future. Now, that sounds very simple, doesn't it? Right? How lovely. Just see and hear and smell and taste and feel. It's a total, wonderful, simple, very immediate life. Right? Very much like the mind of a young child, right? Of an infant. That's the mind. That was our mind. But then there is this mind, right? Which is, in Buddhism, your sixth sense. It is a sense, too. Now, the mind is very interesting. One, the mind, just like the other five senses, has its objects, right? What are the objects of the mind? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, right? These are the things that the mind is aware of in itself. Is that clear? Like, you see those, but I don't see yours, do you? Can you see mine? No. You see? Those are the objects of each of us has a mind that has its own objects that only it sees. Are you with me? Okay, good. Now, this mind, this is where things get problematic. This mind not only has its own objects, right? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, quote-unquote mental events, they're called. It also can be aware of what's going on in the other senses. Right? Now, your eye cannot be aware of what's going on in the realm of sound, can it? It's got like one function. The eye sees. The ear hears. The nose smells. Is that clear? But the mind not only has its own stuff, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories, but it can be aware of what's going on in all the other senses. So as your senses make contact with the world, your mind can create a mental event. Right? Can have a like or a dislike. Can have a history with. Can have a story about. And for those of you who remember being a child, or those of you who are raising children, you actually will see that. If you are understanding of this, you will actually see how this very kind of clear, empty mind of an infant and a child, slowly over time, as they develop language, as things are given names, and as they learn to associate names with things, and as they begin to get some experience with things, liking, disliking, attaching, averting, you know, you can see things begin to get more complicated. Have you noticed that for those of you who are raising children? Okay, that's what happens. Okay, now, not only is that going on, and again, please remember that pure seeing of the eye that just sees an object, right? There's no coloration here. There's no liking, disliking. There's no naming. There's no remembering. There's no past history with, right? It's always in the present. Now, there's something else going on, which is what? A mental event that is arising simultaneously with the perception. And that storyline that gets more and more complex, more and more reified, stronger and stronger as the years go on, right, may have less and less to do with this and more to do with this. Is that clear? That's why it is called delusion. Right? It can have less and less to do with reality and more to do with my thoughts, perceptions, ideas, mental formation, beliefs about reality. That's all going on where? Here? No. That's all going on where? In my mind. Okay. Anybody have a question so far? I want to make sure we're all moving along. Don't feel like, you know, everybody wants to be the A student. But please, this is important. It's like, you know, the meditation on impermanence. Everybody says, oh yeah, the five remembrances, blah, blah, blah. Let's get on with the real stuff. You know, this is the real stuff. Because it's at this very simple level that we veer off until we get to where we are today, where our thoughts about the world, our beliefs about the world, our ideas about the world, and even our emotional response to the world has nothing to do with reality. It all has to do with our thoughts about reality, which over time Because again, when do most of us develop our fundamental, basic, core beliefs about ourselves and the world, and et cetera? When do we do that? When we're what? When we're children. Not when we're mature, wise, with lots of experience, with a well-developed sense of what's real and what's not, and there's good rationality involved. We develop these ideas when we're children. Now, again, children have many wonderful qualities, right? Have you noticed that? But we don't let them drive a car, even though they may want to, because we know there are limitations that they have, right? And seeing clearly, understanding clearly cause and effect is not something that is developed at all in children, or even, as you may have noticed, in adolescence. And even for many people, not even in adulthood. So many of the emotional perceptual responses to life and ourself we develop very early on in life when we are probably least fit to really develop a coherent, intelligent a way of being in the world with any kind of clarity and insight. Now, I left out one important piece, which is in Buddhist psychology called the seventh level of consciousness. There are these six, the five senses and the mind. This is like the thinking mind, the discriminating mind. And this is the manovijnana. This is the seed of self. Okay? Because you might have noticed up to now, we're talking about processes, right? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking, mental events, right? Is that clear, right? There's lots going on, right? All your six sensorium, there's lots going on. Well, early on, something else appears. And many of us as parents, we have nobody to blame but ourselves. Of course, it's just the way it is, though. Because we name our child, right? And we begin to tell them that all these things belong to them. These are your toys. This is your bed. This is your body. This is your eyes. This is not yours. This is, you know. So very early on, a self, an identification with self, begins to develop. Okay? That sense of self, that ego, that sense of individuality, that is what we might say in the seventh level. That is where this thing begins to claim my story as mine. Right? And claims all the activity of the senses as mine, even though it has nothing to do with it. Right? The eye sees fine without a self. But we say what? My eyes. As if somehow we created them or something, or we bought them at the store, we made them. My life. So what even adds to this other thing that's going on is this sense of self. Now, along the way, in our journey from infancy, that self has many experiences. Right? Some of those experiences are very positive, very conducive to the growing of a healthy emotional life. But many of those experiences aren't. They are frightening. They are scary. They are maddening. They are frustrating. They make the child angry. They make the child scared. They make the child afraid. They make the child untrust themselves, untrust others. Safe world, unsafe world. Trust, don't trust. Okay? Is that clear? So, along the way, there is this self principle that begins to organize all our experiences of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling, and thinking around itself. And over time begins to reify a narrative about who and what we are. Not seeing it that the who and what we are is the way we've been conditioned, right? I.e., if you had been taken, you know, if you've been mixed up, you know, in the hospital and given to somebody else, right? The person who's sitting here today may be very different. It's hard for us to believe because we're so identified that this is me. And all the way I see the world and the way I am, this is me. Rather than understanding, well, there were certain things that were you, certain dispositions, predispositions that certainly you came into life with. But even those have been conditioned by experience. Is that clear? This is very important. To understand that the way we see the world, our emotional reactions to the world, the way we see ourselves, was not given. It was conditioned. And the truth is, if the truth be told, is we had very little to do with it. We were the receivers of experience. And in response to those experiences, in reaction to those experiences, because of causes and conditions, we developed a certain repertoire of way of being in the world and responding to situations. It is not as if we, early on decided, I want to be this kind of person. I want to be shy. I want to be fearful. I want to be socially anxious, right? I want to be scared of my own shadow. I want to be overly concerned about what everybody thinks of me. Huh? No. Did anybody remember choosing? Let me think about it. Anybody remember choosing? No. It just seemed that, this is the way it is. This is the way I am. People say that. Well, this is the way I am. No, it's not the way you are. It's the way you were conditioned. Cause and effect. Again, anxiety and fear is a disorder that arises in the mind. Right? And it is basically a failure to clearly perceive a situation as it really is. It's a confusion about what's going on. And it primarily takes place in the world of imagination. Why do I say that anxiety is a disorder that primarily takes place in the world of imagination? Because if there's one thing about fear that crosses the line, or includes everybody, is what? We are not afraid of things that happened in the past, are we? Fear is a disorder of future thinking. We are always afraid of something we are afraid is going to happen. Right? So that is why, since the future has not happened, right? Remember that in reality, the future has not happened. Anything we think about the future is going on in the world of imagination. We are imagining something happening. We are imagining our ability to deal with or not deal with an imagined situation. Again, coming back to our discussion yesterday, that is why learning to live in the present moment, is one of the most beneficial ways you have of not going off into future thinking, which for many people is historically tinged with anxiety and fears. And you might find, those of you who are plagued a lot with anxiety and fears, is that you may find that sort of generally, even when you're not in the place of anxiety and fear, you are somebody who spends a lot of time, or a fair amount of time, thinking about the future, anticipating what's going to happen, planning, fantasizing, right? But you spend a lot of time out there in the future, generally. And then there is this anxiety piece, which has been cultivated for decades, that's also there. But a lot of it is that. In the same way, what do we know about people who are depressed, right, or who go that way? They're where? They're in the past, right? And again, I think what you'll find is a lot of people like that are also just generally spend a lot of time in the past, thinking about the past, thinking, you know, in a benign way. But that shows where they're spending a lot of time. And then when they go down that depressive thing, it's all about, you know, things that should have done or didn't, bad things that happened, or, you know, just endlessly ruminating about, you know, past negative events. I mean, who could feel good doing that? Right? I mean, to me, it's always seemed sort of bizarre, right? You have a negative experience in life. Right? At that time, it was a negative experience. I mean, why keep going over it? Right? I mean, wasn't it bad enough the first time? You know what I mean? I mean, it seems like, you know, why go over it? And over it. That's what rumination is, and we know that depressive people ruminate. It's over and over. Proverbial cow chewing a cud, just over. Put it back down into the fourth stomach and then bring it up again. What's that? Anyhow. Now again, I think another interesting thing, any questions about anything that's been said so far? Please, if you're not, yes.
And that is, what is this awareness? What is this watcher? This thing that brings us back to the present.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that is, come to the 7-day retreat in June, and that is what we're all about. Okay, but those are, you know, those are the deep questions that this practice looks at. What is this? What is this? Right. And is there such a thing as a watcher? Right. Which is like, you know, is there such a thing? I mean, people talk about, very common these days, people talk about what? Their inner child. Right? And I think, you know, inner child is a convenient way of conceptualizing or imagining the wounds of childhood. But sometimes I listen to people and it sounds as if they really think there's like an inner child inside them. There isn't an inner child inside you. Right? Right? I mean, you don't have anybody, you know, this big running around inside you. I mean, that's just the truth. Again, it's a convenient way, like the watcher is a convenient way to kind of divide up the mind a little bit, you know, in a therapeutic beneficial way, right? To develop that capacity to be objective about one's experience and to watch. But the idea that there is a watcher and then there's something to be watched that are somehow different. In Buddhism, subject and object are interdependent. Right? The person afraid and the object of fear, they arise together. They're not independent. They co-create. But that's another whole. We're not going to get into that. Yes, Manfred.
In Western psychology.
Yes, sir.
As I understand it, they want to go back to when this back thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to bring it up again and again. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, wasn't it bad enough the first time? It's past, forget it.
Well, I'm not, I mean, that would be wonderful. So the question is, as opposed to Western psychology, which seems to be so much focused on going back to the childhood events and working them through, what you hear me saying is, you know, it was bad the first time, just forget it and move on in life. I mean, I think in an ideal way, that would be wonderful if our minds were that resilient. I think our minds are that resilient. Right? In the same way, when we have a physical wound, if we take care of it, it heals. Right? And when it's healed, you know, we move on. We don't keep taking care of it. Carol's is using crutches, right? Still using crutches today? Yeah. But, you know, once your leg heals, your hip heals, you will not use crutches. Right? If Carol is... What? One hopes. And one fears the opposite. Right? So again, the problem is that natural resiliency that the mind has to heal itself. Many of us lose along the way or never develop. So therefore, these things have festered deep within our minds because we have reified them, because we believe that they are true, right? And so they have become these solid kind of things that need kind of, we might say, more attention. So it's not as simple. But ideally, moving forward, Manfred, it certainly would be wonderful if you could live your life dealing with life as it arises, letting feelings arise and pass away, and just keep moving on. I mean, there is a learning. We do have intelligence and self-awareness, so there can be a reason to looking at the past in terms of learning, which is developing wisdom. But this endless rumination of going over and over and over is only making our suffering worse. It's just keeping it going. Right? And after a time, what do we find? We don't have to keep it going. It goes on its own. Right? I mean, we can just sit here, come up here to, you know, Southern Dharma, sit in the meditation hall, and it can just arise by itself, right? Now, why is that? It's because causes and conditions. We have every time, this is why understanding karma and the actions of one body, speech, and mind is so important, to understand that when we think something, and we act and we speech, we are leaving imprints in our seventh level of consciousness, which in Buddhism is called our storehouse consciousness. We are leaving seeds, imprints of everything we do. And that is why, you know, these things keep bubbling up. Where are they bubbling up from? That's why you can sit in meditation. You go, wow, these things just never stop. Well, these are just the seeds of experience, things we've thought and said. Or these days, you know, it could have been something we saw on TV or something, you know, and it's left an impression. So that's why we need to be somewhat careful with that. Yes?
I understand that and get that fears and anxieties about things that may happen in the future Mm-hmm. That's imaginary, because obviously you don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Well, and when we're rational, we know that. But go on. Yes.
It seems to me, consciously or unconsciously, that's informed by what's happened in the past. And so to totally separate them feels...
Well, no, well, again, I mean, I'm not saying that. Obviously, again, we have been conditioned. Okay, so our fears, right, why do they arise? Because within our mind, it's not in the object, right? It's within our mind. What has conditioned our mind? The past actions of our body, speech, and mind, right? I mean, that's what's conditioned it. Okay? And the more we have reified our belief that these ideas and thoughts and feelings we have about life and situations are real, solid things, and have acted accordingly, they have just only gotten stronger and deeper. Again, that is why, in terms of Manfred saying, yeah, ideally, if you're a healthy human being, you don't let this stuff, get deeply in. I mean, how do things get deeply in? Not, you know, they can't do it by themselves, right? You know, that old thing people say, you know, well, you made me angry. You ever hear that one? You know, you made me angry. It doesn't work that way, right? Does it? No. Somebody might have done something. That's the object. Somebody did something. Somebody said something. But the emotional response or the perceptual response of how we see that event is arising where? Where? In our mind. Nowhere else. Nobody can make you angry. Anger is something that arises in your own mind. You know? And you gotta, you know, how you think somebody can get into your mind, push the certain, you know, we even say that. You're pushing my buttons, right? How do you know how to push my buttons? Well, whose buttons are they? They're your buttons. You know, if you want to leave them out there for anybody to push, don't blame me, you know, right? I mean, if I had buttons that were sensitive, I wouldn't just be leaving them out there for anybody to push, would you? No. They're your buttons. Take good care of them. And heal and transform them. So they can't be pushed. So this understanding in dealing with anxiety, that whatever your fear is, it is arising only in your mind, that the thing itself is not the cause of your fear. The cause of your fear is your own mind that has been conditioned to perceive it in a certain way. Okay? Somebody was saying the other day that they are afraid of, because there are bears up here. They're afraid of bears. Right? They hear the word bear and they go, what? Fear. Right? Now that's interesting. And they think what? Well, of course. Right? A fear of bears is normal. Right? What?
Well, you said bears. I'd sign that too.
I guess it is. Well, that's it. But that is interesting, right? Because again, but I was going to say, if you were a hunter and somebody said there are bears running around, that you'd do what? You'd get happy and go grab your gun, right? If you were a nature photographer and you heard there were bears around, you'd go get your camera. Wow, what an opportunity, right? So we see that even that same, or let's take beer. Obviously a man of experience over here. Now let's stay within the confines of good behavior in the classroom. Right? Somebody sees a beer and they go aversive, right? Because of their conditioning. Somebody sees a beer and they see pleasure, attachment, go toward. Beer is what? It's just an object. It's just something you drink. I mean, it has no inherent, you know? I mean, people talk about, you know, like with food, you know, I can hear the chocolate ice cream calling me. I mean, people talk that way. Chocolate ice cream does not have a voice. And if it had a voice, it doesn't have kind of extrasensory powers that it can kind of go through and get into your mind. Is that clear? We talk crazy talk. Right? I mean, I remember one retreat years ago. I don't know if anyone was there. But we were at a retreat center, and the cook was every day made cookies. And I was online, and I was just noticing, like, in certain people, it was like, wow. I mean, their eyes were lighting up, and, you know, I could see they were hovering around it, and take one, take two. You know what I mean? I could tell this was like a big deal, you know. So in the... So I grabbed a cookie, and I took it with me. And then the next day at a Dharma talk, I held up the cookie. And I said, look at this cookie. Isn't it beautiful? Tasty. And there may be people in this room right now who, when they see a cookie, the cookie is an object of what? Pleasure. Because of conditioning. Pleasure. And oftentimes when things are pleasurable, we attach and we grasp. That is the nature of this delusional mind. It wants to have. It must have. Okay? And a number of people raise their hands. Yes, they'd like to have it. Okay? So then I took the cookie. I took the cookie and I just went like that. And there it was, on the plate, in crumbs. I said, who would like this? Nobody raised their hand. Well, what's the difference? It's the same stuff, flour and sugar and flavoring, right? But when it's in a certain form, our mind sees it a certain way. When the same thing's in another form, it's an aversion. Well, the cookie has not, you know, it's still the same cookie, but the attachment aversion, can you see? It's all in the mind. There's nothing inherently there in a cookie. That's, you know, when you see it like that, you know, I mean, let's say you're attracted to somebody in a physical way. Wow. Right? Physical attraction. Wow. Now, let's say the next day you saw them sick. Not coming out of their nose, coughing, right? Eyes runny, right? Same person. Where's the, you know what I'm saying? Where is it? What's, well, you know, it's all here. It's not there. That's a very fundamental thing to get. Because when we are dealing with anxiety and our fears, we have to understand that it is a problem well within our purview to heal and transform, because it is all arising where? In our mind. Whose mind? Your mind. What is this mind? That which is listening to me right now, that's your mind. Okay? And when your body has certain sensations, when your mind has certain thoughts, when your imagination or capacity to visualize goes in a certain direction, you become afraid. Right? That's all that's going on. It's going on in your mind. And because it's going on in your mind, you can change. Because, remember yesterday, cause and effect. It is arising in the mind. Your fears are what they are because of past causes and conditions, and your misuse of the mind based on misperceptions, and now you can change your perceptions, change your belief system, change how you deal with the arousing of the sensations, etc., etc., and your mind will change because these things are not permanent. You were not born with the fear of snakes. You were not born with a fear of poverty. You were not born with a fear of people disliking you. You were not born with a fear of being alone. You were not born with I could go on and on, right? None of you were born with that. They are fears that you developed. Is that clear? So, please, any questions? Because in the guided meditations this afternoon, we're going to begin the real journey with working with the fears. But I want to kind of, again, you feed somebody, you give them a fish, you feed them for a day, you teach them how to fish, they'll be eating for the rest of their life. It's important that we step back and have some understanding of what's going on in this mind, the way I've outlined it to you, so you can know, have a schema, a paradigm for dealing what's arising. You see, this is the problem because we often, sometimes in the therapeutic mode or sometimes in the self-help mode, we may find, or somewhere in the medication mode, we may find a technique, a pill that works situationally, right? But we don't get the learning, And so it comes back again. And then it comes back again. And so what we want to get here is that it's more than a specific therapeutic intervention for a specific fear, or is it a matter about coping or lessening? It's really understanding that the whole thing can be uprooted. Because the basis of all your fears are based on, a fundamental delusion of a separate self. I don't know if we can go that far in this retreat, but at least it's based on misperceptions, irrational beliefs, a distortion, we might say, of imagination, a misuse of imagination. I remember talking to somebody who's afraid of flying, and you know what they said they did? They get on the plane, they sit down, and the plane's about to take off, and they start imagining the plane breaking apart in midair and crashing. I mean, like, what? That's crazy, right? I mean, why would anybody do that, right? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, and yet we think, somebody said, well, I always do that. And again, what do we know about somebody like that? We know that when they read the newspaper or read the news, when there's a plane crash or there's something, who do you think's on it? Right? Everybody else just turns the page. Oh, that's too bad. But that person, because why? That's a reaffirming that my belief is true. Right? Even though it's so random. Right? Right. The person with the bears. You don't think if they're flipping through the paper and they read something about a bear attack that they're not in heaven? They're in heaven. See, my belief is true. It is a dangerous world. And those are just kind of easy examples, but we do that in so many of our social interactions. Again, we'll, over these next 3 days, we're going to really unpack all this. But I want to kind of, again, the bigger picture question.
Is there a difference between, I mean, the way you work with fears in terms of whether it's consciously or subconsciously the way they arise? Sometimes, that, you know, like the examples that you give is very conscious, like I'm not afraid of bear or
okay.
But sometimes you can be in a state of fear or anxiety and not necessarily recognize what puts you there.
Yes, so that is why, and you'll, what's your name again?
Yeah.
Tina. That is why we'll be working on that. That again is why, in the Buddhist tradition, when you're working with quote-unquote difficult emotions, or, you know, mindfulness is the first step, okay? That you are aware, you're mindful when this unpleasant feeling, emotion, sensation, thoughts are arising. You're observing. That's the key thing, right? To be conscious. See, in Buddhism, there's no, like in kind of some aspects of Western psychology, you talk about the conscious, the unconscious mind. In Buddhism, there aren't all these minds. It's just one mind, but there are things that we're conscious and aware of and things we're not. Okay? Now, the practice of meditation and mindfulness helps us become more conscious. Okay? So you can stop. You can first notice, doesn't feel at ease in there, right? Something's going on. You don't know. So you stop. We'll be doing that today. Okay, so yeah, because everything else flows from that. If you don't know what's going on within you, and if you can't be present to it, then working with it and healing, transforming it, it will be very difficult. So that's why, again, you understand now why yesterday we began with just practicing mindfulness. You know, mindfulness of what's going on in the body. Mindfulness of what's going on in the mind, right? So we have that general capacity, right? Again, if we only practice these things when the afflictive emotions arise, it's not going to work, you know, because we don't have the competence. So that's why we practice daily to develop the skill of mindfulness, right? You know, with drinking tea or, you know, just of the body and the breath and the scan. So we kind of have a sense of what our body-mind is like free of affliction. See, there has to be a baseline. And many people don't have a baseline. For example, how do you know you're sick? It's a simple question. How do you know you're sick? What? Yeah. Right. But the basic thing is you know you're sick because you know your baseline is feeling well, not sick. Right? If you never have that, right? I mean, if you were born with a stuffed nose, so to speak, and you always had a stuffed nose your whole life, you would think stuffed noses are normal. You wouldn't say you were sick, would you? No, it's, you know. So, physically, we have to have a sense of health so we will know when we're sick. Right? We all know that, don't we? It feels differently. Even without the symptoms, it just feels differently. The problem is for many of us, we don't have a baseline of mental health. You know, what does it feel like to have? But again, I think we do in a certain way. We just don't notice it. You know, we might say the mind that is free of afflictions, the mind that is at ease, that is calm, right? That's a good baseline. Okay. So you know when you leave it. Is that clear? And again, mindfulness reveals to you these positive mind states, these positive feeling states. So you have a baseline. So when you leave it, you know. Yes.
Do you think it's possible to have an emotion or a feeling of being not precipitated by thought? or do you think there's always a thought precipitating whether you are aware of it or not?
Well, I would say, again, the mind is involved, right? I mean, because we could say the eye just sees. There's no coloration. It's just a physical sensation, right? So the mind, you know, it is in the mind that emotions, we might say, or feelings arise, okay? Do I believe that? Yes, okay? To be a human being is to have emotions, feelings. We are feeling, we're not rocks, we're not pieces of stone. We have feelings. The problem is, and I don't know if this is what you're getting, is, again, rather than our emotional life being based on a response to reality as it is, our emotional life is primarily based on this. So it's always distorted, you see? We want to get this thing straightened out so we can have for example, take a child. Now again, they're a little extreme, but does anybody have young children? Okay. What, do they, your daughter, does she have emotions? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now when she's happy, right? Do you know she's happy? Okay. When she's sad, do you know she's sad? Okay. When she's angry, do you know she's angry? All right. Now, generally speaking, let's take her afflictive ones, okay? When she's angry, or maybe she might be scared, you know, maybe there could be something. How long do those emotions last?
They're very quick.
They're very quick. Okay, so this is the answer. Originally, our emotional life was very much tied to real-life events that we were responding to, right? Good things happened, we were what? Happy. Scary things happened, we got scared, right? Scared in the night, daddy comes in, child is what? Happy. Fear gone, right? Child angry, you do a little something, 5-10 minutes, anger gone. The emotional life is very natural because it's responding to situations. Again, nothing is permanent. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, they just arise and disappear. That is their nature. It's not because you have to do anything. That child, you know, I mean, your child doesn't have an advanced degree in psychology, does it? No. And yet it, right? And yet, amazingly, it can have a healthy emotional life, right? Isn't that amazing? Right? Now, our problem is that, and this is fear is a big one, we cultivate afflictive emotions. Right? They can't stay around by themselves. Their nature is just to go, as Manfred said. Right? Situation happens, you feel something, you respond. You know, what's next? But we don't do that, do we? We ruminate and we obsess over and over and over. Over and over and over. Right? Is that clear? Depression is a disease of rumination. Fear, anxiety is a disease of obsession. Repeat, repeat, repeat. Imagine, repeat, imagine. Over and over again, the plan goes down. I ask a person, how many times have you imagined that scenario? I mean, hundreds and hundreds of times they've imagined planes going down. They don't even have to be on a plane. They can just think about it. Right? Can you see? Again, I want to stop. But, you know, again, when you think, you know, the old saber-toothed tiger and all that stuff, right? The reptilian brain and all that stuff. Again, the tiger, the saber-toothed tiger, was real, right? It was right there, right? Our fear of flight, the whole physiology of it is based on what? Real life-threatening danger. Is that clear? So all the things you feel, the
the sweaty, the agitation, the palpitations of the heart, you know, all the constriction. That's all programmed within us to deal with real danger. Right? Is that clear? Real danger. That's why the adrenaline, that's why the energy flows, and that is why, again, very dangerous, that's why we need mindfulness. One of the characteristics of fear response is called tunnel vision. Anybody know what tunnel vision is? It's like that. Feared object, danger, can't think about breakfast, can't think about lunch, can't think about my shopping list, right? Only one thing. What's that? It's like the feared object. The problem is, for people today, it's not a real danger. It's an imagined danger. Right? And when we get that thing rolling, that fear response rolling, and that tunnel vision cracks in, that's why you can't break into it. Right? That's why you can't break into it. Because you're just... not true. I see one thing, the tiger. Except it's not a real tiger anymore. Just imagined. But we're still obsessing. Which again, which was a good thing when there really was a tiger. Yes?
The example you gave of the snake, and I saw the snake climb down here, holding a crutch in here, I saw three copperheads on the trail.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I would be mindful. Walked right
up on it. Okay.
And yes, I screamed and ran away. And, you know, and
it's
just, even thinking about it, I can feel like that.
That's good. That's
pretty
beautiful. Yeah.
I feel it. Oh. I don't want to feel that when I see the sign.
I understand. But
now I'm like, okay. Okay, I guess
you
got probably one in here.
Yeah, that's...
But then I start thinking, so my mind puts... No,
but... Here, I mean... Test case, here it is. That's beautiful. So that's what, see, we don't need to read anything. What's your name?
Emily,
thank you. There it is, right? I mean, were you phobic about snakes before?
I wouldn't say really, no.
Okay.
Cautious.
I mean, there are poisonous snakes and aggressive snakes, right? That's real, isn't it?
Yeah.
All right, but most snakes are benign. That's real too, right? Okay, isn't that true? Okay, but look what you just did. So, this is it. Now, luckily, you experienced as an adult, you have better capability than when you were 5 years old. Okay, but this is what's happened, right? Now, it doesn't have to be even a real snake. It can be a sign. It can be a picture, because you now have this mental formation, right, in your consciousness. In your Vlaya Vijnana, which snake danger, okay? It's no longer has to be real. It can just be mention a snake. And you immediately, how are you doing right now? You can feel it right now? Yeah, can see. What are you feeling?
My palms are sweaty.
Palms are sweaty. What else? Throat.
Yeah, I'm not breathing. I mean, I'm breathing.
Constricted, yeah. Shallow breathing. Yeah, right. That's called the fear response. And you can see how amazing it is because, Emily, are there any snakes in this room that you're not telling us about? No. Right? There are no snakes, really? So in reality, is there anything for you to be afraid of right now? No. And yet you can give yourself a full-blown, panic, or whatever you want to call it, right? Just thinking about it because of conditioning. Is that clear? This is it. Thank you, Emily. I mean, you know, this is it. And you can see how hopefully you can, you're glad you're here, you can do interventions so it doesn't, but you can see, left to its own devices, it could just become obsessive with you, right? And all of a sudden, you like to hike? Yeah, I mean, all of a sudden, hiking could become, an anxiety-ridden experience for you because you're all... Yeah, there you go. I mean... Yeah, see how wonderful... You see how wonderful that is. What's changed? Emily's changed. changed. Her mind has changed around snakes. She now has this mental formation, danger, and it's become obsessive. Right? Many people in this room have the same thing. This is classical, so I appreciate it. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, so the question is, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Mm-hmm. Okay. And there are different theories of that. But I think we would have to say that it is outside of again, we might say with Emily, when she was walking along the trail and she saw a poisonous snake, her fear was not conceptual. It was direct, right? But now it is mediated by perception. And yet the feelings arise. I mean, you know, you're trying to tease it out. They arise together, right? They arise together. And that's why traditionally when you're working on fears and anxieties, you unpack it both at the physical level and you unpack it at the sensate level and you unpack it at the cognitive level, okay? Because they have all, as you see in Emily, they've all come together, right? Right? She can see a picture of a snake, visual, right? No cognitive. And yet immediately there will be sensations in her body, and immediately your mind will tell you what? Danger. Can you see? So it all arises together, and in Buddhism they're called mental formations. They mean they go beyond just an abstract thought. They are thoughts and feelings and experiences and memories that have kind of have formed together. It's a formation. You know, that it's not really, but we just use that as an idea. That's a mental formation. And now Emily has a mental formation around snake. It is no longer a word. Right? Maybe for somebody else, snake is just a word. It has no positive or negative connotation at all. Right? Same way for our friend over here. Beer has a very positive connotation. You mentioned the word. Even if you're trying to say bear, he hears beer. I mean, it's
you have way too much fun, Fred.
I think that the mental form is
cancer.
Yeah. That it is the memory
and
the emotions, then we have this perception, then we have memories and
right, and that's what happened. You know, that in the beginning, you know, you tell the child, you know, this is your toy. You just name things. You just give things words. They're labels. They're very neutral. But over time, through attachment and aversion, and the growth of self, a whole repertoire of formations arise around those things that were just named originally. Now again, ideally, would we like to have primarily our thoughts be unattached to emotions? Just let them be thoughts? Yeah, and let most of our experience be very direct and immediate? Yeah, I mean, that's life. But anyhow, life is also moving quickly toward lunch. So please remember, leaders of the groups, we're doing musical chairs today. Everybody move to the right. And in the guided meditations today, we will begin to work on mindfulness and fears. Okay? But I wanted to give sort of a bigger picture. Thank you. We'll end now.